It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Marquette pollster Charles Franklin says while most media focus on monthly job numbers, Wisconsin's long-term economic outlook is way more important and not looking great.
First, Congress is back in Washington after a two-week recess, and for some legislators, that means confronting some questionable behavior.
New York's Michael Grimm has been charged with fraud. Louisiana Representative Vance McAllister, who was taped kissing his aide, has announced he won't be running for re-election. And the Ethics Committee has said it's looking into four other lawmakers as well.
Well, progress on any of the big issues like immigration, minimum wage, and maybe repealing Obamacare is being reported as still unlikely. There may be some movement around the margins and in the states themselves. USA Today politics editor Paul Singer is here with us. He joins us every Wednesday at this time to talk Congress. Paul, it's great to have you back.
Oh, nice to be here. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Well, lots of stuff happening, even though first day back more or less from recess. New York Congressman Michael Grimm, former FBI guy, was indicted on 20 counts of fraud, other charges as well. What happened?
Grimm has been an interesting character since coming to Congress a few years ago. This indictment alleges that after he left the FBI and before he ran for Congress, he owned a restaurant in New York. The indictment that the FBI unveiled against him says that he was basically paying undocumented workers off the books in cash. He was paying them out of the cash register, and in so doing, was avoiding taxes, was avoiding federal reporting requirements, and was also, of course, reducing the earnings or the apparent earnings of his restaurant, so he was avoiding taxes there too.
Besides being illegal, how does that square with his position on issues that relate to that?
Well, he's an anti-tax Republican, so I guess that's fair. I think what there is no good position for a member of Congress to say I'm in favor of paying people off the books and dodging taxes. I mean, it's just not tenable. You could make a whole bunch of arguments, political arguments about whether small business regulation and taxation is too high and whatever, but that wasn't the case here. They also, by the way, allege that he then, while still in Congress, was trying to cover this whole thing up. He was using outside email accounts to ask people to lie, just a whole bunch of bad things, all of which, we should note, the congressman denies. I mean, he says he didn't do these things, or it's a witch hunt. And he's innocent. So we'll see how this plays out. But it was certainly quite a splash and not the kind of thing you would like your member of Congress to have to stand in front of the press to answer for.
Well, as bad as that looks right now, he's not the only guy on the hot seat before the Ethics Committee. What else is going on?
Circus is in town. there's the one that's not yet in front of the Ethics Committee is the fellow McAllister from Louisiana, a first-term congressman who ran on a platform of a kind of a Christian conservative family values fellow, and then shortly thereafter was videotaped making out with somebody on his staff who was not his wife. That one, interestingly enough, he said that he's not going to run for re-election, but he came back to serve out the rest of his term. And a bunch of Republicans are saying that he should just quit and go home now. They have not said that yet about Grimm, interestingly enough. And part of the difference is, I think, in Grimm's case, he denies that he did anything wrong. In McAllister's case, he's already apologized and said he shouldn't have done it. So we have the kissing congressman for the next couple of months.
And these two guys, they're far from the only ones who've been in this kind of situation lately. A lot of the people we're talking about with ethics violations are looking at our GOP members. But is this an especially fertile season for the Ethics Committee? What do you think is going on here?
You know, it's interesting. It has been a fertile season for the Ethics Committee. In the past couple of months, they've announced four or five other investigations, and several of them are Republicans. There's Kathy McMorris Rogers from the state of Washington, who is accused of mingling her campaign and her office money, or office funds, that is official taxpayer funds. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to keep them very separate. Steve Stockman, a congressman who's announced he's leaving. He was running for Senate and lost. He was a Republican Tea Party guy from Texas who was involved in all kinds of misuse of his Federal Election Commission accounts, that is, his campaign accounts. We sort of knew he was up to something. I mean, his campaign never really existed, and he's a bit of a kook. Part of it is that there is a process now in the House of Representatives to actually get publicity onto these ethical charges. It's the Office of Congressional Ethics. I think we've spoken about it before. They launch investigations, and the Ethics Committee has to announce them. And I think part of the difference you're seeing now is that this process has developed a kind of rhythm to it where around this time of year before the election season starts, they have this window of opportunity to actually get all these investigations into public. And so we see them. Now, I should also mention there's a Democrat up here that I'm excited about. Luis Gutierrez is accused of having a lobbyist on his staff. And we like that one because that was from the reporting that we did here at USA Today. So we're proud of that one.
Well, I guess all this begs the question, is there anything to be done about this? Or is this sort of the long tradition of what politicians do? And this is just what the Ethics Committee is there for.
You know, I think the interesting thing for me, and pardon me for being a bit of an insider junkie here, but one of the interesting things for me is whether they actually do anything. The general cycle of these cases is that, you know, reporters find things that look funny. Members of Congress deny. The Ethics Committee investigates, and nothing ever happens. There's never any punishment of any meaningful sort, in part because the way the ethics process is designed, it's the public humiliation that is supposed to be the punishment. There's not much else Congress can do to punish you, except for throw you out, which they're just not likely to do. They hate taking punitive action against their own members. So, you know, part of it is, you know, members of Congress are being called to task for, in some cases, very technical violations. In some cases, they are sloppy. And in some cases, in many of these cases, you'll see the issue is campaign money. It's how they use campaign money, the amount of campaign money, what it's flowing into. It has a corrupting influence, and certainly it has this influence of making everyone suspicious of their member of Congress because there's all this money floating around.
And we're just going to introduce the next topic and then come back to it, but shifting the focus to legislation, the Senate voted on raising the minimum wage today. That was blocked as expected. Democrats do have the majority in the Senate, so what happened?
They could not get enough Republican votes to overcome a filibuster, in short, and they knew that was the case going in, and they held the vote anyway because they wanted to make a point. And we can talk more about that, but you're going to see a lot of it the next few weeks. A bunch of votes that nobody expects to succeed.
Right now, we're speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer for his weekly update on Congress.
We're back now with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to talk about Congress.
And we're taking your thoughts about Congress people behaving badly right now. What issues should legislators be focusing on? What do you think about Congress people and some of the ethics violations we're hearing about? Do you think this is something we should take seriously? And is it the public humiliation aspect that Paul Singer was talking about? Is it enough of a deterrent to stop future bad behavior? And then looking ahead again, what would you like to see legislators focusing on? Our number, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're also curious to hear what you think about the defeat in the Senate today of the minimum wage raise that was under consideration. And Paul, let's go back to that. Defeated on a filibuster today, and as far as the minimum wage raise goes, but this is something the Democrats are not rolling over on this one. They've said already that they're going to bring it back. What does that signal?
Well, I mean, it's a winning political issue for them. The Democrats believe that there is broad public support for an increased minimum wage. And in fact, you'll see states around the country have been raising the minimum wage. There's more than a dozen of them, I believe, have recently passed bills to raise their own minimum wages. This is for the federal minimum wage, of course, we're talking about in the Senate now. And the Democrats think it's a winning issue. And so they, of course, whether or not it passes, they think it's a winning political issue. So they schedule these votes knowing they're going to lose because they want to have Republicans on the record opposing. And they want to be able to go into an election season saying, see, we're fighting for you. We're fighting for the middle class. And you'll notice also that President Obama had scheduled a press conference for about an hour or two after the Senate vote. So he was prepared to jump on and pile on, which is exactly what he did. He said, you know, tell your member of Congress this is a mistake and they should be voting in favor of this thing. And we need to pass a minimum wage.
Well, this was not necessarily a close vote, so why aren't Republicans worried about this? Clearly, this is a pretty transparent strategy by the Democrats. Why not more concern on the part of Republicans if, as you say, it's a popular issue?
I think the Republicans argue that raising the minimum wage misses the point, that raising the minimum wage simply raises the expense to a business and therefore reduces the number of people that the business can hire and works as a drag on economic growth. Their argument essentially is, it might be better to have more jobs that don't pay as well than fewer jobs that pay better. And also, their argument is that this is unnecessary, that the states can handle this where they want to, and the feds don't need to be involved. And this is the way Congress works, right? This is never going to get a vote in the House. The Republicans control the House. The Senate is controlled by the Democrats. There's not much the Republicans can do about that, except say no when the vote comes to the floor. So that's what we do.
Well, let's talk about the states angle. You referenced that a couple times, because some states are saying, forget Washington. We can decide this on our own. Late yesterday, Hawaii decided to raise its minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. It joined other states like California and Connecticut. So how significant is this state action in the big picture of national politics here?
Well, the Hawaii one was a little interesting because this morning the first thing in my inbox was a statement from President Obama congratulating Hawaii on raising their minimum wage. Because, of course, A, Obama is from Hawaii, and B, this is his opportunity to make fun of the U.S. Congress by pointing out that the states can do the things that he says are the right thing, but the U.S. Congress can't. When a state raises minimum wage, it works both ways. On the one hand, it gives ammunition to those who say, look, this is popular, we should be doing this nationally. And it also gives ammunition to the opponents who say, well, we don't need to because the states can do it themselves if they feel it's necessary.
Does it say anything in particular about the balance of state and federal power?
I don't know. It's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about it that way. I mean, it certainly says that there is... America is not of one mind on a lot of things. You will see more and more division in this country at the state legislative level, particularly, and that's why you'll see widely different responses to things like the Affordable Care Act and whether or not we should expand Medicaid. Some states say, yeah, it's a great idea, let's do it, let's embrace this thing, and some states dig in their heels and say, no, this is bad for America. And so you really see two very different battles going on. One is the national agenda, and one is the state agenda. And you guys in Wisconsin have had that in spades with your governor, taking some very controversial positions that have been leading edge of what are also national battles.
And as far as the future of the minimum wage battle, so we've got this motion in the states that seems to be happening, Hawaii the latest. Where do you see the future of it in Washington, though?
The Democrats have promised to make this vote happen again sometime in the next couple of months. I would expect to see it several times in the next couple of months. I would expect the outcome to be essentially the same each time. Until we have a resolution, the Senate and the House at this point are not really capable of sitting down and working out a deal on this. It has become too much of a political issue for both sides. We have an election looming, an election season that'll keep us very entertained for the next few months. I don't see them figuring out a way to pass a federal increase this year.
And Paul, we wanted to get your take on something else making news. Last Thursday, House Speaker John Boehner mocked fellow House Republicans for being nervous about dealing with immigration. And he did it in a very particular way that I'm not going to try to do justice to by reading it. Let's listen to him doing it himself.
But here's the attitude. Oh, don't make me do this. Oh, this is too hard.
There it is. And he's been trying to explain that ever since.
Yeah, he said, I mock because I love.
What are people saying about that? What's the reaction in Washington where you are?
Well, there's been some reaction amongst the conservatives in the Republican Party who said that they're concerned that Boehner is trying to secretly cut a deal on immigration with the Democrats in the White House. And they don't want that to happen, and they think he's trying to raise the heat on them. And he actually went to a meeting with the Republicans this week when they all returned from their recess, and basically said, "I'm not doing that. I'm not trying to cut any deals. I'm pushing on this issue. I think we need to talk more about this issue, but I promise you I'm not going behind your back."
So it's not the tenor of it. It's just what they're afraid that it might mean.
Yeah. Yeah. They're afraid that he's gonna cut a deal. Now, he also said once again, as he has said on several occasions, that the real barrier to immigration reform legislation is that Republicans don't trust Obama to implement the law. And that seems like an insurmountable barrier, because I don't see how you fix that anytime soon, and certainly, again, anytime before an election season when they're both out there bashing each other on the campaign trail.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll talk to you again next week.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot. I'll talk to you soon.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time for an update on Congress. When we talk about job creation in Wisconsin, we usually talk about monthly reports or make comparisons between job numbers under former Governor Jim Doyle and those under current Governor Scott Walker.
Our next guest says that when we look at growth that way, we might miss the big picture. He says there may be important lessons about Wisconsin's long-term economic health if we just take a step back. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, what do we lose when we look at those monthly ups and downs in the job numbers in the state?
I think the most important thing is that the month-to-month changes are fairly small. If you look at the state as a whole, we have about 2.4 million employed people. And the month-to-month changes are typically on the order of a few hundred to a few thousand, but 2,000 or 3,000, not a whole lot. And so we're talking about, percentage-wise, very small movement from month to month. Where job creation really pays off is over the longer haul, when we sustain additional jobs at a steady clip month to month and year to year. And I just think that as we've gotten so caught up on the short-term performance, we've missed some of that larger long-term performance issues.
We'll dig into those longer-term issues in a bit, but it seems like, I think maybe leading up to the recall election, there was more media coverage, more coverage from the parties and the political campaigns of those jobly numbers that I can remember ever seeing before. We all got really excited when those numbers came out.
That's right, and I think that continues. That's driven in part because of Governor Walker's pledge to add 250,000 jobs over the first 4 years, his first term. That was a pretty strong promise, and let me put that in perspective. If you're going to add 250,000 to over 4 years, that requires adding 62,500 per year to get there. During his term, we've been adding about 30,000 a year, or about half what we would need to reach that goal. So that raises the question, was 250,000 ever realistic? If we look back at the 1990s during the expansion period there, there were quite a few years that we were adding about 60,000 and one or two where we actually got to 62,000. And so that shows that in the big expansion of the 90s, it really was possible to at least come close to that goal of 250. But instead, if you look at the period after 2000, and people may remember that we had a recession in 2000, 2001, we had to climb out of that, and having climbed out, we then got hit by the Great Recession. If you look at the period from 2004 to 2006, which was our growth period after that early recession, we added jobs at about a 27,000 a year clip. Now, in the last 3 years, we've been adding them at, again, about a 30,000, maybe as high as 32,000. The numbers fluctuate a little bit depending on how you calculate them. But either way, that says that since 2000, in our best growth periods, we've been running at about half the rate of the 1990s, and we were running at about half that rate during the Doyle administration, and about half that rate now. the policies of the Doyle administration and the policies of the Walker administration have certainly been dramatically different from one another, but neither seems to have produced substantially different levels of job growth during the periods of expansion outside of the Great Recessions.
So that's now we're starting to get into the long-term lessons you're looking at. Why is it that growth, even in good times now, isn't as good as growth in the good times back in the 90s?
Well, this is where I think a better discussion would benefit us all. If we talked about not whose plan is going to suddenly produce massive job growth, but rather what are the features that are holding our economy at a lower level. One part of it, of course, is that the national economy since 2000 has not grown at the substantial rates of the 1990s. And whether you're a Democratic or a Republican governor, you're largely at the mercy of the national economy on some of this. Another part is the structure of our jobs. We're heavily invested in manufacturing. And some of that manufacturing is growing much more slowly or even shrinking, though we do have elements of manufacturing that are higher growth as well. What about preparing citizens for those jobs? That would be education. That would be technical training and so on. We have these conversations quite a bit, but I think that they get obscured by the month-to-month fluctuations. I think it would be useful for us to sit back and say, at the rate we're going now, it's going to take us a long time to recover to where jobs were before the recession. Right now, we're still about 65,000 jobs short of the peak employment from before the Great Recession in 2007. So I think this is an important discussion for us to have, and a little bit more of the long-term focus and a little less on the month-to-month fluctuations might help us discuss this in a reasonable way.
But how do we get to that conversation when, if I'm a politician, a political party, I'm looking for a talking point, a selling point for this month's press release from the current election cycle? How do we get policymakers, politicians in particular, to turn away from that ephemeral stuff that's going on now and look at those long-term trends?
Well, I think there are clearly incentives for any politician to emphasize their accomplishments and the other side's shortcomings. So I think it's probably too much to hope for a candid discussion on this from any party during an election campaign. But both sides do lay out their vision of what kinds of elements stimulate growth. And we will certainly see, or are seeing now, some differences between the Democrats and the Republicans about what kinds of economic policies they'd pursue. But I think looking, again, somewhat in the longer term, there are a number of groups in the state, both policy analysts and for that matter, interest groups, that spend a great deal of time talking about how to stimulate job growth in the state. I think paying some attention to that, but also confronting them, and for that matter, asking the questions of our political candidates about how they see this long-term performance and how that matches up against our aspirations, I think that is a way to go.
You, I believe, first introduced this idea talking to a particular audience, people in the media. What would you like to see from the media to try to drive this conversation from, you know, the month-to-month to the decade-to-decade?
Well, as you say, this did begin with a speech I gave to a media group this past week. And my point was simply that when coverage focuses rather myopically on the month-to-month changes, I simply think that misses the longer-term picture. Now, I think a variety of news outlets have also been providing the longer term, and so I don't mean to say that it's never there. But I think the discussion could usefully be moved to some of these broader picture issues and longer-term performance, and especially comparative performance over a period of years rather than a period of a month or two.
Campaigns for governor are often decided by one side or the other making a better case that they will be better for the state's economy. How much of an influence on the state's economy does a governor really have in a state like, say, Wisconsin?
That's right. I think certainly in some things, the national economy is far more important for driving state performance. Where you do see some differences is in some part, business creation and incentives to business to create, in some part, in wages, and we're currently engaged in a debate about whether minimum wage increases would help or hurt employment in the state, and that's one of the kinds of debates I'm talking about being important for us to have and flesh out the differences between the parties in that. And then we have some of the longer-term, more structural things that don't have quick payoffs, but that includes the emphasis on job training, the emphasis especially on technical schools and preparation for people for jobs in the manufacturing that we do have, which is still a very substantial part of the state, and much of that manufacturing is pretty high skilled. So I think there are areas where both parties and candidates are talking about and beginning to lay out ideas for that. I think that speaking to the media, it would be helpful to put a bit more emphasis and coverage on those elements of the campaigns and pull back a little bit from these month-to-month fluctuations.
As director of the Marquette University Law School poll, you've got your finger on the pulse out there. What is the public saying about Wisconsin's economy?
The public has somewhat mixed views about it. When we ask about your personal finances, about 75% say they've recovered from the Great Recession, but that still leaves something close to a quarter who say they're still not back to where they were before the recession. When we ask about jobs, it's about evenly split. About 45% say the state is lagging behind other states. About 49% say we're keeping up or even doing better than other states. But specifically on the 250,000 job promise, 80% don't think we will make it there, and that seems like, from the public's point of view, an enormous majority that don't see the chance that we would get there, and certainly the job performance numbers suggest that would be virtually impossible at the current rate to add that many jobs between now and December.
We'll leave it there for now. Charles Franklin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, where he directs the Marquette Law School Poll, also the co-founder of Pollster.com.